Hola amigos, and welcome to the Rolling Ball. That's the Leicester Tigers fans podcast, which is getting a little emotional at seeing its Cubs all grown up after an unbelievable day of international rugby on the Saturday, which complemented, of course, a resounding win for a young Tigers side in the Premiership Cup. Yesterday, we're going to be casting our bloodshot eyes over the burning embers of a thumping win in Coventry against Wasps, engaging in some hot transfer gossip following the shock George Ford move to Sale, and announcing the winner of the number 8 shirt in Cult Corner before rustling through the garbage for those unpolished gems in contention for that scrum half slot. As always, I'm Mike, and I'm introduced by the man behind a view from LE2, Elliot, who is surrounded by a cardboard box fort. You having fun there, mate?
Mate, packing is living a dream. So last weekend is full on box packing, sifting out all the possessions I've got, and trying to make heads of sense of it all, and failing massively.
Still staying in the Shire, though, aren't you? So you're still keeping your season ticket.
Absolutely. Going to Melton Mowbray to the land of pork pie.
Goodbye, belt size.
Yeah, well, mate, my rig shot to pieces at the best of times, so it's going to be completely destroyed now.
No, you got into prime wedding shape, didn't you? Well, that's it now. You've locked her down, and now you can properly let yourself go. That's the way of it.
I don't think I could ever be described as prime wedding shape. The suit was a bit tighter on the day than I expected it.
Well, it looked pretty good to me. Anyway, have we got anyone to say hello to today, Elliot?
Yeah, we've got a few shout-outs from the week. So, as always, thank you very much for getting in touch. In no particular order, thank you to Taj Frajine, Chris Haywood, Ben Whiteman, and Daniel Hammers for getting in touch with us.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I'm going to give a shout-out to two people who I don't know if you'd have seen, Elliot. One, we've got a ranking from America, or somebody rated us in America, and it doesn't show up unless we sort of do a weird log-on thing on iTunes. And somebody gave us a 5-star rating, or a few people have, and someone left us a review. And it's our friend from Virginia, who I had hypothesized was part of the CIA, and they were keeping tabs on us. And he's assured us that he's not from the CIA, he's just a fan. Thanks a lot for the rating. I would point out that is exactly what someone who was from the CIA would say, wouldn't it? A spy is always going to say they're not a spy. So, but thanks for listening all the way out there, and I hope you're doing well. And I'm also going to say hello to John, who is the best Sainsbury's shop assistant in the world, the nicest man. He's always got something nice to say to everyone. And he asked me what I was doing this evening. I said I'm doing a podcast, and he's been listening to it every week for the last few weeks. Doesn't even support Leicester. So hello, John. Wow. Thanks for listening. You're the nicest man in the world. And aside from that, we are very happy today to be joined by special two guests. They're a bit like Transformers when you or Power Rangers, when you combine them, they make Chris witty. And there was a terrible mistake where there's been a mix-up where Chris Witty is currently being asked about George Ford's transfer to Sale. And I'm about to ask Adam Witty and Chris Edgerton from Radio Leicester about the availability of booster shots in the county. But we're going to avoid that. So very, very happy to be joined by Adam Witty and Chris Edgerton. What a treat to have you guys on. Adam, you're looking recovered from your run this morning.
Yeah, it was great. It was great fun. 7K with Kevin Sinfield this morning as part of the extra mile challenge. I felt a little bit like I was jumping on the bandwagon. In fact, I almost certainly was. But it was an amazing thing to be a part of. Kevin Sinfield is a lovely, lovely man, actually. There's people like Brett Deacon involved in the run as well. So I did a 7K from Barrow-upon-Soar to Presswall Hall. And it was absolutely great, absolutely brilliant experience. People lining the streets, giving Kevin Sinfield cash in brown envelopes on the side of the street. It was quite a sight. And I mean, he's still going. What we're recording at 7 o'clock. So he's still got quite a way to go. Another 12 hours to go. He's an extraordinary man.
That's phenomenal. And you can legitimately say that you were the pace setter.
I was. Yeah, very briefly. He's the pace actually was pretty remarkable considering how much he's doing. I think he was still going probably above average pace for a 5K, and was talking about the need to slow it down. I think, you know, he when he was doing the 7 marathons in 7 days 2 years ago, he was doing them at 3:30 in total, which is well above average. You know, he was doing that after having done six the previous day. He's an extraordinary athlete, even though he'll tell you he's not a runner. He's an extraordinary athlete. It's the mental side of it, I think, of him as well.
Yeah, I mean, talking whilst running is a big no-no for me, apart from sort of gasping for air and telling other people who are trying to talk to me to shut up is generally as much as he'll get out of me when I'm trying to run. Chris, I suspect, were you not there today? Were you not leaping along, like setting the pace? Or was it more of a cheer on from home job for you?
Well, I couldn't unfortunately find a support vehicle enough to be able to bear my weight for the 7,000. It's a bit like being a 6'6" tall. It's a bit like I've always wanted to learn how to ride a horse properly, but I've never actually been able to find a dray horse where I could actually learn on, because that's about the size of horse that I would need. So lounging in the back of the support vehicle, I'm not sure would quite be the done thing. For me, even though I have done a half marathon, but nowhere near like the pace of budding triathlete over here. So, I watched from the sidelines. Sadly, my commitment at Radio Leicester were prevented me from taking part. But no, very fair play to Mr. Whitty for showing Sir Kev quite how to do this running.
I don't think I managed that. Unfortunately, he very much showed me the way.
So we're going to talk, obviously, about a lot of stuff to do with Tigers today. And it's great to have you guys on because you are, of course, the gentleman in the know. You're on the front line of the more official side of the BBC. I like to think that if people were going to listen to two podcasts or two different shows, they'd listen to yours for information and professionalism. And they'd listen to ours for hyperbole and swearing. And so if you combine the two, you have a full, I'd say, Tigers package. And we're both bringing things to the table there. You, of course, if you want to go and get in touch with us, send us an email at therollingmall@outlook.com or follow us on Twitter, rollingmallpod, all one word. All right, well, only one place to start. And worst fears confirmed last week. Despite Elliot and I trying to build up as much confidence as possible to saying this is all just agent speak, and as well he should do. He should be speaking to other clubs just to bump his price up. Unfortunately, the rumours are true. 40 is off to sale next year. Now, I think we talked a lot about it. The first thing to do, again, is apologise about our constant slating of Pat Sanderson. But of course, it isn't Pat Sanderson. It's Alex Sanderson. Adam, Chris, I don't know if you listened last week, but we managed to get into a pretty strong rant about how we thought that Alex Sanderson's conduct was pretty appalling in the build-up to it, particularly announcing he'd had conversations and, to my mind, putting a lot of disruption and a lot of pressure on Leicester and Ford. Unfortunately, I thought everything I said was valid, apart from the fact I directed it at his brother, who had nothing to do with the situation. It must be a Pat Lamb thing. The name Pat is just sort of like...
It's psychological trauma, I think. It's just, it's so scarred into your brain, mate. You just can't get Pat out.
Yeah, so we need to apologise for that again. Absolutely correct. Alex Sanderson, whose name is Mud now in this house. But of course, that rumour has come true. Fordy apparently told people at Leicester early last week that he wouldn't be renewing and he would be signing for sale next season. Now, obviously, there's two things to that. One, we're obviously going to be wondering why he's leaving. And I suppose the final thing is then we get to have that fun chat about, is anyone going to come in his place? Elliot, how did you cope with the news last week?
I didn't go on a massive drinking thing to get over it, but I was just massively disappointed. It's a shame, really, just because of how settled things have been at the club and how well he's been playing. So it's a bit of a bolt from the blue to obviously... see that he's off and he's deciding to leave at the end of the season. So it sort of throws us out of the settled state we've been in, and it throws up uncertainty again, and something which we've been away from for the last couple of years, really, since Steve's come in. But no, it's one of those where it's a professional sport and these things do happen, but it is a shame from a Tigers point of view, especially if you look at every game he's played in so far. He's been absolutely phenomenal all season, so... It's just a massive shame from my point of view.
Yeah, and the point to say is there that people who might question, oh, what's his commitment going to be like for the end of the season? Don't be naive and don't think that these conversations haven't been going on for weeks and weeks. And he's been putting in performance after performance. So his professionalism can't be questioned, I don't think. I think what a lot of people get frustrated in is that he's gone through all the crap years with Leicester where we've been absolute garbage. He's now got a team, biggest club in the country. We're on the up. We're playing some great rugby. He's got a great pack. And now he's leaving when it looks like he could be on the cusp of building something. Adam, obviously, from your point of view, is it a strange decision? It doesn't strike me as being a rugby decision. There must be more factors in play there.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think from what me and Chris both understand as well, he has probably taken a pay cut to do this as well. So it's as far away from a financial decision as can possibly be. It's an interesting one. Talking to fans about this, I've been struck by how philosophical they are about the whole thing. There is no better reason than wanting to go back to your roots and back home. I think it slightly gripes because you see George Ford actually as his home being two different things because he's been at Leicester for so long. He came through the academy. He first played for them, when he was 16, I think, didn't he?
Yeah.
You sort of think that George Ford is homegrown. And so the idea of going home when he has been with the club since he was a teenager seems slightly strange. But of course, he's going back to a place that he's just built a house in. He's got businesses there. I think his partner's up there as well, his family. You can't think of a better reason for that kind of thing. I've been struck by how philosophical fans have been about it. The key question is what comes next for me. It's a fascinating decision ahead for Tigers, but I can't fault George Ford's decision making. It's just such a shame. It's just such a shame because he's such a fabulous player. And it's striking that people are so open within the Leicester coaching team. Speaking to Brett Deacon on Saturday afternoon, how open they are and saying how disappointed they are about this. You don't often get that, really. And that shows the mark of the man, the mark of the player.
Completely. And I think that we will all share that we don't want to pretend that this emotional reason for moving to another club is any less of a reason than rugby or finance. Mm. So those are all very, very valid reasons and all equally valid. And who is to go and say that actually moving back to your roots where you feel comfortable, where you feel at home, and particularly when he's getting to an age where he might be thinking of starting a family, that could well be the place he wants to be. And that's a very valid reason to move. So yeah, when he goes, he'll go with our best wishes until he plays us, of course. and if Sale are sort of picking up points elsewhere, we'll want him to have a few off days. But he's been fantastic and I hope he'll continue to be. And as you say, what comes next is going to be interesting. But before we do that, Chris, one of the things I heard thrown around one of the various Facebook groups, don't know what your thoughts on it are, was that there was actually a slight breakdown in relationship between him and the club because he'd been lowballed in contract discussions. Now, that doesn't ring true with what I understand how his contract works, that he had a year for renewal left, so he couldn't really be lowballed on it. Does that sound right to you at all?
No, it doesn't, although there is a school of thought that suggests that Leicester quite actually wanted to get Ford off the wage bill to be able to strengthen the rest of the world. I can't see that. I just don't see that at all. Mm. I actually think, well, from what I was made aware of, the offer to keep Ford, it was a very, very generous one. It would have certainly made him close to being the highest paid player in the history of the club. Wow. And they definitely wanted to keep him. But I do think there's a bit of history here that we need to actually reflect on. And that is that George Ford was one of the last players to agree to the wage cut when they were imposed 12 months ago. Now, he wasn't happy. There were plenty of players who weren't happy. Plenty of players who ended up staying were not happy about that. And I do wonder whether that first put the seed into his head to say, do you know what? I'm not happy. I want to move on. We know that the halfbacks had to really fight to get some input into the game plan as well. So he's a strong character for. He's not everybody's cup of tea. He really isn't. He plays the media game and, fronts up and will always, give you, he'll actually give you a decent interview, but he's not there to annoy people and stir things up, as you see from some players elsewhere in the squad and also outside the squad. He's not like that. He will stick to the line, and I think that's partly why he ended up signing up for those wage cuts, and now he's moved on. But I do think it's a case of him wanting that fresh start, and obviously it being close to his home in Saddleworth definitely helps, but I don't think it's the only reason why he's gone. Not at all.
It's a tricky one as well, because you wonder what kind of team he's going to be walking into at Sale. He's not going to be, as far as I understand the way the salary cap works, he's not going to be a marquee player because he's moving from another club, so he can't be a marquee player. So he's coming out of there wage bill. And even if he does take a cut, that is going to mean that they're going to have to make room for him elsewhere. And you imagine where that's going to come from. They need to up their England player qualified quota. So that's going to be coming from some of the big South Africans that they've got floating around, most of whom are in the pack. So you wonder how that squad is going to be balanced next year. It's going to be quite interesting.
Well, just bear one thing in mind on that, Mike. Diaga is the one that's been linked most closely with the move back home to South Africa. Check how many games he's played for Sale. Very, very few.
He's their Manu.
Yes, he is. And they've got Manu.
Yeah, I was about to say.
And they've got the actual one.
I think the difference is that Manu's been incredibly unlucky. Diaga has just been permanently injured whilst he's been over there. So if he goes, that will almost clear the way for Ford to wait on its own. But there's always some things about front loading as well and back loading. So what you could easily do, because this period that he can't be classed as a marquee player lasts for two seasons. So when they say, I think that's the key when Sale said long-term deal. For me, that means 3 years minimum. So it might be that for the first 2 years he's under the cap, but then on the third, the last deal of his year on his contract, then basically he becomes a marquee player there, and then maybe a few of the wages that would have been in the first 2 years of it are backloaded into the third. So there are always ways around this cap, always.
Just while we briefly mention Manu, obviously we'll talk about internationals later, but scored a great try and then promptly pulled his hamstring. I really hope this pulls to bed the absolute bullshit that has come from Messrs. Diamond and now Sanderson about all, we'll treat him well. All these thinly veiled critiques of how he was treated at Leicester, suggesting that we rushed him back and he was injured because of how he was treated at Leicester. It wasn't. He was treated wrapped in cotton wool, particularly for the last few years.
Just on that, you notice all the strapping that he had on that leg when he went into that. I don't want to libel anybody, but I suspect he was carrying that going into the game. I would be very, very surprised if he wasn't. I can actually understand why, because as we'll touch on, that was a massive game for England taking on the Springboks. They needed to win that. I can see why, especially with Farrell not being injured, I can see why they were desperate for Manu to play. But it's the way it goes. It really is the way it goes sometimes.
And it's the way it goes with him. He's a great asset when he's fit, but when he's fit is the question. Okay, so we've talked obviously about Fordy and where he's, obviously we know where he's going and perhaps why he's going. Let's have a look now at perhaps the more positive side of that coin, which is what happens next. And as Adam said, that is a really interesting point. Elliot, what's your school of thought on this? Are you in the stick? We've got, obviously, you've got Freddie Burns and Hegarty there as well, who are both good tens. Then you've got youngsters coming through. Or are you in a position that you think we need to bring someone else in?
I'm in the camp of, I think we should get some players in across the squad and directly a 10 replacement as well. Excuse me. I think Hegarty and Burns and Lancaster are really good options to have in the squad. And I think, as we saw on Saturday, Lancaster is a great prospect. But I don't think either of them are strong enough contenders to lead the team in that 10 slot. So I would like to see a nominated first choice 10. As much as I really like Freddie and Hegarty, I'm not sure they're first choice picks. And I'd like to see us bring in a specialist first choice 10 and use Burns and Hegarty as our depth and use them across the season to help boost the squad overall. I do think it gives us an opportunity with Ford going. As much as I wanted him to stay, there is an opportunity, as always, when players leave, to look at the squad and look at the salary cap. And we've got a marquee slot now available. So I think we'll be looking at that and making our decisions accordingly. But I'd be disappointed, as much as I say, I like Burns and Hegarty, if we didn't get someone in to replace him.
Well, obviously, the rumour mill already starts, and we did our bit with unsubstantiated bullshit that we were circulating on Twitter. Somebody points out Andre Pollard is following Tigers on Instagram. You know, the conversation is going ahead, you know, and I'm sure that they are talking. They probably are. Adam, what are your thoughts on it? Do you think that the club is definitely looking to bring someone else in at 10? Is that a deal breaker, or is it only if they're available and only if they're available for the right price?
I'm struck by how many people say stick. I agree with Elliot actually pretty wholeheartedly on this. I think they need somebody approaching the quality of Ford. If there is somebody there, clearly, if you are a fly half and a talented fly half, you are thinking and you're saying to your agent, well, there's quite a lot of money up for grabs, perhaps Leicester Tigers. Now, Tigers may decide to go down a different route, but they were clearly willing to spend a huge amount of money on their fly half. Although, of course, he could be a marquee player, so it was outside the cap, but they clearly have the ability. They are clearly willing to spend quite a bit of money in that position. The problem is that I think there are two problems, and Chris will get onto this in more detail. The changes in the way that the Premiership is approaching foreign players will be fascinating. And that means that it will be difficult for Tigers to go out and get somebody like Andre Pollard or Quade Cooper, which I've seen mentioned as well. They could break the bank for somebody like that. But, and Chris will confirm this, you have to play, is it four? Non-English qualified players, a maximum of every game throughout the season. And if you don't, then you don't get £750,000 of funding from the RFU. So that means to me that they're probably going to have to go for someone who is English or English qualified at the very least. And so I can, my guess is they will go one of two ways. They will try and get somebody. I mean, Alex Lazowski is an option for them. I think what they may do is go young and talented. Somebody like Finn Smith or Jacob Umaga is a long shot, but somebody like that who is a young, talented prospect in that position that they can grow and nurture, get the likes of Hegarty Burns to get 2 or 3 years a little bit further down the line and bring somebody who can be the next forward through the ranks. That is probably how I see them being able to work the financial and the level, the financial aspects of this and the level of quality needed.
Danny Cipriani not making an appearance then.
No! You know what? I thought Ryan Lamb was the most unless-like fly half ever signed. Danny Cipriani would be the ultimate one, really, wouldn't it?
I'd almost want to sign him just so somebody could film Richard Cockrell's face, because I'm sure he still keeps an interest when he hears Danny Cipriani signed for Leicester. I'd love to. Or even Steve Borthwick's face when, you know, it comes coming over to, oh, we've got some options for you, Steve. Danny Cipriani, I'd love to see his reaction to that.
Yeah, if Richard Wilkes just comes and said, look, we've got some suggestions for you. We've spoken to Danny off a record and he's keen. What do you think? I can't imagine that's going to play down too well.
It might be a nice tactic if you're looking to sort of promote someone, you haven't got a great list and you just want to sort of push the least bad one, you just layer it with, you know, Danny Cipriani's to try and sort of make the others look better. But Chris, can you, Adam alluded to it there, what are sort of the ramifications then that we need to be thinking about here? I mean, it's not just a pick your favourite fly half and we sign him job, is it?
No. I'm with the majority, I think, of your correspondents. I think I prefer to wait until after the World Cup and see what's there, because I think it takes that long to be able to line up a top quality fly half. And bar Pollard, who I'm not necessarily convinced by compared to his form for Montpellier, and he has been injured a fair bit as well. I'm not sure about that, but he's the only one that's on the market at the moment. So I'd be tempted to give it 12 months.
So do you think then that the club hasn't got a contingency that's been working away in the black background? Do you think that this has sort of very much come out and they're like, crap, right, systems go?
No, not at all. Because for a start, you don't sign four players who can cover fly half as one of their main positions. That's not something that you normally do. They've been succession planning ever since Mike Ford was lined up for the plank. No, I don't buy that for 1 second. I'm just saying that's how long sometimes it takes to line up a top quality international player in a specific position, especially fly half, where there are very, very few available. That's what I do. I think the club will go quicker than that. I think they'll look to get somebody in. And I think Pollard might just be the man.
I do as well, but I'm sort of agreeing and disagreeing with you, because I think that Pollard is a big risk, because he is going to come with a lot of money. He takes up another foreign player spot. I was just looking back at the Rugby World Cup when he was excellent for South Africa, really excellent, very solid, controlled kicking, everything along those lines. But what I've noticed, particularly since he's had an injury, a very serious injury, ACL injury, and that's very hard to come back from, he was known for being defensively solid. I've seen him miss a lot of front-up tackles. He gets done with quick feet now, which is a sign of someone struggling to come back from an ACL because you can't spring off your knee. And I know that because I was slow before sidestepping, before I did my ACL, and now I'm just static. And then the other point I've noticed is his place kicking, which was very, very reliable. I mean, it was pretty decent during the autumn tour, admittedly, has looked quite ropey as well. He is a different fly half to 40. I think the one thing we have to accept off the bat is we're not getting George Ford, that kind of player. He is almost one of a kind in how he plays. There are guys who can do a very good job, but probably in slightly different ways. So for me, I was quite excited at first to see Pollard play, but then I've been looking a lot at his game footage and I don't think he's quite up to scratch to where he is. And I've seen him miss kicks, well, at the weekend, for example, that you would expect him to get an international fly half to get. And they were obviously very important ones. With the price, the fact he's going to be unavailable for a lot of the year, I don't think that's a sensible way to go, actually. And I think particularly with the English player rule, like you've just pointed out, of the really important rule of having enough English players in your squad, I think
there is, there is another option, actually, Mike, to bear in mind. Leicester, as long as France or Japan haven't picked them up, Leicester can have their pick of any non-capped Australian or South African fly half. That's just a fact. So if they were to pick one up there that was also perhaps dual qualified,
yeah,
I'm thinking here of a fly half equivalent of, say, Jasper Visa or someone like that. Now, you're getting into Finn Smith territory there.
Yeah.
Probably also getting into like Guy Porter and Harry Potter territory potentially as well. That might also be an option. But the way that Borthwick has constructed this squad, it's not necessarily for the long term. He's been blessed by a lot of academy talent, that is for sure. But the signings that have been brought in have been brought in to deliver success within the next 2 to 3 years. So if that follows the same path, I think they'll make a signing in the next 3 or 4 months. It may not be straight away, but I think they'll get someone in.
I think all signs lead to Alex Lazowski, personally. I can see why that Pollard gets mentioned. Lazowski seems a perfect fit. He's at end of contracts at the end of the year. He's never going to be first choice for Saracens whilst Farrell is there. That's just a fact. He's never going to be first choice 10. He plays a lot at 13 now. And 10 is his natural position. And we saw him fit there when he played for Montpellier. And I thought, actually, he was exceptional against us in the final. He is a guy who plays closer to the line than Pollard does, and he is a physical presence and a great runner. He's not going to have the tactical kicking variation that Ford has, but Elliot, I mean, you and I are along the same lines here. You're part of this Lazowski sort of pushing crew, because my old man, I need to say just very quickly, is very much in the stick group. He thinks that, like, you've got Freddie Burns, you've got these kids coming through, you've got Lancaster, who I'm not convinced is a natural 10, and you've got Joe Woodward, who is could be mustard from what I hear. But he is young. The fan base isn't going to accept another season of rebuilding with a guy who can't lead the team to success over another year or 2 years. We've heard rebuild for the last 4 or 5 years. Once we start to have success this year, he's going to be a victim of it. He's going to have to carry on delivering. And that's why I think that he will go for a good name, an English name. And I think if it's not going to be a young talent like Finn Smith, I think it will be Alex Lazowski.
I agree. I think if you look at the age of Lazowski as well, his same age as Ford is now at 28. It gives you the next 2 or 3 years to bring through your Woodward and Lancaster. And I do think it gives you a bit of time to allow to have your academy talent to come through unpressured. I also think he is at the peak of his career. He wants this is probably his big move, Lazowski as well, to be first choice somewhere. And again, I think the Pollard point, having someone who's going to be unavailable for a lot of the first half of the season, I think it's counterintuitive. We've seen this year having a fast start to the season and how much positivity it breeds and the momentum that comes off the back of it. I do think having a fly half who's missing who isn't there for a lot of the pre-season and who's unavailable for the start of the season, it just puts you in a weaker position. You have to play catch-up. So I think having a 10 who can be there to work with our attack coach and to work with the back line in summer, we are seeing what at the moment the fruits of having a really good pre-season. So I think you need to go down that way of thinking again. And so having someone like Lazowski who can be there from day one of pre-season, get involved in the attack coach and get involved in shaping the attack of how he would like it to go, I think that's going to be crucial in terms of who we want to bring in. I'd say that across the board for all the replacements as well. That's why Pollard would be a fantastic choice. I'm slightly reluctant to go down that way and put all your eggs into one basket. Because I always think, if as soon as you get like a star fly half, if it doesn't work, you end up snookered a little bit because you've got the weight of expectations on you, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, I agree with you entirely. Let's wrap this up. Okay, short answers. Elliot, who are you going with? Stick, twist, and who, if it is twisting?
I'm twisting with Lazowski.
Adam?
I am also twisting with Lazowski.
Chris?
I'd stick for 18 months and see who's available after the World Cup.
You're looking at Marcus Smith's contract counting down, aren't you? Tick-tock, there we are. Stranger things have happened, haven't they? Oh, there's a question for you. Would you sign Lazowski now? Or would you go a season with no other fly half? And I don't even know if Smith will be available another season. I know that it'll be about 2 years since his last extension.
I think you'd really struggle to get Smith out of
Quincy. Not for seven figures.
If Bristol can throw money at him to get him out of there, then I don't know who else could, to be honest. And
in the nicest possible way, he is the most Harlequins player around.
I was going to say that. I think that is exactly the point. I don't think he'll ever leave Harlequins.
The hard-nosed fight on a Tuesday.
I can't see Borthwick and Marcus Smith having a similar sort of philosophies on rugby in exactly the same way that maybe Ford and Borthwick have got a good alignment.
There is one point, actually, boys, that Borthwick's been tipped so obviously with an international job in two years' time, might actually be better to go now rather than maybe in 18 months, because then the question might be, okay, Steve, are you going to be here in 2.5 years' time?
Yeah, you don't really want to be doing a head coach and a fly half search at the same time. I don't think that's quite ideal.
If only there was a coach and fly half package, perhaps even a father-son relationship that came as one.
Give it time. See what his lad develops like. You never know.
All right, well, that's enough about the great abandoner, George Ford. And I'm still dealing with it well.
Well.
We're going to now move on to great news as Tigers headed down to the... Oh, what's it called, Adam? You told me this before. What's the arena?
The Coventry Building Society Arena.
The Coventry Building, the CBS
Rolls
arena.
Off the tongue.
Mm, very nice. The Rico Coventry, where it is, the half full... one stand full capacity that they had there. And unfortunately, we were met by, a Wasps side that was really putting the Y in young. It was very, very young. I mean, we had 20-year-olds out there, the 18-year-olds and a bunch of low knees out. And we put them to the sword, 55-7. Question marks, obviously, about how much you get out of a game like that. But you can only beat what's put in front of you, as they say. Adam, Chris, you're there or covering it in your Radio Leicester gig, and obviously you've been doing this for a fair while now. We all enjoy listening to it, particularly when Premiership Rugby decides to only show half the games. You're filling some big shoes, if you don't mind me saying, of Bledin Jones. How has that been for you recently?
I think the difficulty is in losing Bledin was a couple of things. I think one is that he came across on air as he was in real life, which is a very nice person, a very decent person, as kind-hearted as you can be. And I think we had to try and keep that. And I think we do try to anyway, was to keep the decency in the content. He never had a bad word to say about anybody. And I think that was very important to keep things light-hearted, to keep things positive when we could. But of course, Bledin was a bit of a baby-faced assassin in some ways and would stick the knife in. And when he stuck the knife in, you felt it. When he criticised, you felt it. And so I think keeping that kind of mantra has been very important. I think the most difficult thing is that we have lost the most knowledgeable man about Leicester Tigers from the past 50 years. He was a man who went to every game and had an incredible memory, an incredible recall of games, of what happened in matches. you know, you called him up. We did a package on the 1997 Champions Cup final when Tigers lost to Brive. And, you know, I just called him up. He was down 15 minutes later and was just recalling it like he was there 15 minutes ago. I think that's the real difficulty that we have lost in him, is the recall, the knowledge, the context. You know, what if he knows what a good player is for Leicester Tigers, because he's got 40 years of, or he had 40 years, 50 years of knowledge to be able to draw on from that. He's so greatly missed by everybody.
Chris, you're obviously on the comms a lot now as well. I mean, how is it trying to feel? I mean, you've got a wonderful voice anyway, I must say. It's lovely, deep gravelly. You know, you need to work on your Welsh accent a bit. But how do you follow in those footsteps?
Well, I am conscious that I am actually the first Englishman to do this job on a regular basis after Van and Bledin. And my dad worked in Colwyn Bay for about four years. True story, absolute true story. Does that count me as Welsh now? I don't know.
They'll take you. I mean, I think, you know, they'll take anyone in the national team, even if they're from England. So that'll do.
Yeah, you'll get a call now. You'll get a call now, Chris, getting called up to the Six Nations squad now that you've said that you might be Welsh. So,
yeah, with their injuries as well.
The new granny gate is upon us, really, isn't it? it's very strange, actually, not having Bledin around. And without delving into self-pity here to any extent, it's maybe harder for me than Adam, because I've been working on and off with Bledin since, goodness me, when was it? When did I first start working with Radio Leicester? About 2003, 2004. Had a bit of a big gap in between that, but we stayed in touch in that when I was down in London freelancing. So it's very, very difficult to go to games and not think about him. And the way we used to go in the studio, and Adam will back me up on this, before they changed it for this season, we had to park up where we parked up at City, and then we'd go around the corner of the clubhouse stand and go past the Walk of Fame every time. And that was really hard on the Ulster semi-final, that first game after we'd lost him. That was quite tough.
He had that ability to put so much character into the game, didn't he? And it was that combination of knowledge and to be able to paint a picture when you're listening and actually say, oh, I can see where they are. I can put myself in the crumbie where he's sat and I can see where they are and I can see what he's seeing. And I thought that was a remarkable skill. It sometimes wasn't helped, obviously, by some of the names which you spend 5 minutes trying to pronounce, or sometimes my favourite, when you get overexcited and get completely the wrong end of the stick, when he'd be saying, there's a try for Tigers. No, there's a line out 10 metres back. And you'd be like, it doesn't matter. Anyone else you'd criticise, you could get away with it.
Do you know what? I don't know that outside of Leicester that Bledin was appreciated as much as he needed to be. There are an awful lot of tributes, but you saw that, particularly on away trips to Europe. And I'm really glad Adam got the chance to do a couple because, and he'll back me up on this, literally everywhere you go to with Bledin, and it never happened with Steve Johnson, with Tim Barwell. I love them both dearly, the regular summers. But wherever you went with Bledin, nobody wanted to talk to any of us. No, I didn't even want to say hello to us. It's like you'd just hear from the other side of the room, Bledin! And then he'd come over and go and talk to them. It'd still be there about half an hour later. And us miserable gits at the back, we're just thinking, all right, okay, can we just have a pint, just have a bit of peace and quiet? And then we'd go and wander over and then have a whale of a time. He's so engaging, so charming, and I think all the odd mispronunciation, the odd idiosyncrasy, nobody minded.
I think it added to the charm, I think. When you looked at all the, for someone who grew up listening to Radio Leicester across for the football and the rugby, the voice of Bledin was so iconic, especially for rugby. And I think that when all the tributes came out, I think everyone had their favourite mispronunciation that they had. And I think it added to the charm.
Quite apart from the mispronunciation now, ironically. Quite aside from the mispronunciations, I quite liked Mapapa Papalangi. There was a few of those in there. Adam, you were talking about McConaughey. He just gave up on that one.
Yes, it was 2019, I think, at the Rec, and he was calling him McNocky, and I think just Nocky by the end.
McNocky sounds sort of like the latest bastardised McDonald's knockoff of an Italian delicacy, doesn't it?
That's the Italian version of McDonald's, I think. I think you can have a McNocky over there.
That's true, yes, that's true. I always remember when we went to sail away and we stayed in a hotel because obviously they're all Friday night games. You finish by the time you're done, it's 11 o'clock. So it's ridiculous to drive home in the middle of the night. We were staying at this hotel in Salford and he came over to me and said, and my girlfriend, and she said, do you want, what do you want? She said, I want a red wine, please. So he goes up to the bar, turns around and goes, you want a Rocco, Kat? You want a Rocco? And everybody looked round and went, what on earth is he talking about? And then somebody worked out, somebody worked out that he meant Rioja. it was just genius.
Chris, you've known him for many years. I mean, when he was more sprightly, was he a bit of a handful?
Well, the thing is, he didn't age, damn him. He never aged. You compare the picture that actually on the Walk of Fame to him in his later years. Honestly, they're very little different.
Yeah.
It's like most things. It's the whole package. So he had a condition where when you were driving home from a night, Adam spots this straight away. He had a genuine condition. We're not making this up. Genuine condition that in the middle, when it went dark, he'd fall asleep. So you would. There was no way you would put him behind the wheel of the high-end limousine that BBC Radio Leicester always provide for us to get home from various places. So you put him on the back seat, and literally, you'd be going out there, you'd be chatting away to him in the car. I'd say, oh, great game, that one. Like, yeah, absolutely. It was marvellous. And then 5 seconds later, gone. Absolutely gone. Yeah. Head back against the seat, snoring his head off, just gone. And he'd be like that on and off pretty much all the way home.
Were you working that time when he didn't turn up for the second half because he got talking to a fan at half-time?
I love that. If you've not seen it, our colleague Mike McCarthy, who's back working with us actually, somebody filmed it from behind him. And there's this wonderful bit. He sort of pans from Mike, who's looking around, terrified at the prospect of having to do a whole 40 minutes on his own. And then 30 seconds after the second half kicks off, he walks blooded with the biggest smile across his face, all sheepish, like one of the pupils he used to teach in Little Bowden. And then he just picks up and gets on. Mate, you can see almost visibly relaxed. And it's one of the funniest videos you'll ever see. But honestly, but that's why he was always held up, because it was always, he'd always have time for everybody. He'd stop and chat, hear stories, and be genuinely interested in you as well. Just an incredible and actually one of the funniest men that you could ever meet. Sometimes intentionally as well.
Just
wonderful.
He was always a man, like I say, he was very special to everyone who listened to him. Obviously more special, I know, to people who work with him. But looking at your job now, of course, you're sort of carrying the mantle and you're talking about a new Tigers team, a new era, very exciting. You don't have the most exciting man at the front of it all in Steve Borthwick. He's a very efficient, very interesting man in many ways, but he doesn't give an awful lot. And I suspect perhaps some of that might be historical distrust. Some of it might even be the fact he's ultimately tactically not wanting to give anything away to his rivals whatsoever. How do you get that balance between trying to build that relationship but then also give the public what they want?
I think this is such a fascinating thing. Steve Borthwick is the biggest challenge I've ever had in my career, which isn't hugely long, I have to say, but he is unlike anyone I've ever interviewed. I will try and do as BBC a job on this and be as objective as I can on this. One of the things I will point out to people, and I think they probably would have picked this up already, I can count on the number of, you know, the fingers of one hand, the amount of people that have asked me about me. I'm talking any sports person across any sport at any level who has engaged with the journalist who has asked the questions. And Steve Borthwick does that.
Wow.
He will always ask me about my life, what I'm doing, what I've been up to. If he's 2 minutes late to the press conference, he will apologise. And Chris and I will have been to press conferences all over where head coaches, players have turned up 25 minutes late and haven't batted an eyelid and have not said anything. And of course, we're just journalists. And of course, you know, maybe it doesn't maybe it doesn't matter whether people are on time to see us. I don't know, but it tells you something about the man that he does that. I think you're right that it comes from distrust of the press. I think when he was an England captain, he was stung by the press. And I think I'll be brutally honest and say this, and I respect a lot of my colleagues in across the spectrum of journalism. I think occasionally, and I think rugby is particularly guilty of this, there is a smarminess about the way that sometimes people particularly will write. And he was, I think, struggling for form at that point, wasn't he, when he was England captain? England was struggling for form as well. And I think there were things that were said and written about him that he obviously didn't like, fairly or unfairly. However, it is a challenge. There is no doubt about it. It's a challenge interviewing Steve Borthwick. And I find the fact that he won't tell us about injured players very difficult. I still don't understand that. And I still don't think that it is fair to withhold that information. He essentially, and to be fair, I can see this argument, thinks that I think it's a tactical thing, but he would say it's a breach of medical confidentiality. Now, in a sense, he's right, but there is a difference between saying somebody has COVID, somebody has a long-term illness, and saying somebody's torn their hamstring. There is a difference between those two things. Interviewing him is tough, and you know that there are things he will not say. And Chris and I have a discussion every night or the day before or on the day before a press conference to discuss what we're going to talk about and what, usually midweek anyway, I'm going to ask him. And it's hard. There are so many areas he won't discuss. There are so many things that you know won't get an answer to. I think the thing I find most frustrating is sometimes he won't. I'm so interested in him as a rugby mind. He is one of the best rugby minds in the country. And I wish that he would share his wider views on the game, on the changes that you're seeing. But he keeps it safe. And maybe he's doing it right. Maybe he's doing it right. I don't know. But I think he can do this when they're winning. It will be very interesting to see if and when they start losing, whether that approach will still work, and whether certainly, you know, let's say at the end of this season, he's plonking the Premiership trophy in front of me when Tiger, you know, having just won the league at Twickenham, whether he can really pull off the, I'm thinking about the next game, I just want to improve. I don't think that will work.
There's a gap between us and the other teams. I mean, exactly. If he dropped that line,
exactly.
I mean, from the league,
exactly.
That would be hilarious.
But I can see him doing it. I can see him doing it.
Oh, 100%.
But he is a very decent man. He's a very decent man. I just wish he'd open up a little bit more, and I wish he'd trust the value of the media, and I wish that he would just share a little bit more. I wish the rest of the public got to see how much of a nice man he is, quite frankly, if I'm being brutally honest.
Let's go back to the CBS or the chronic bowel disease arena and have a look at that Leicester Wasps game where, as I said before, it was an excellent win, albeit against a massively depleted Wasps side. Elliot, pretty good display, some pretty exciting performances there again. But I think, as Adam will mention as well, how much can we really take from that, given the Wasps side we were facing?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I was quite struck by the comments that Brett Deacon has made over the last couple of days. One about giving them all a rocket at halftime, which I found quite interesting, and JVP taking leadership in the dressing room which I found actually a real good ticking the box for him, because I do think giving him the captaincy over the last couple of weeks has been a great choice. And he strikes me as someone who's got a big voice in the Leicester Tigers team over the next 10 years. So I was really pleased to hear that from Brett about how JVP led to charge on that. But I was also struck by Brett's comments about how they approached the last couple of weeks, about what we're trying to get out from it. And he said about we want to get some players some minutes and develop the team and develop players off the back of it. It's. I think from that, if you look at those as your objectives, I think they've got to be pleased over the last couple of weeks, because players who hadn't had much game time, who you'd consider in and around the first team, have now got minutes under their belt. It's almost like a glorified pre-season in a way, where people have had run-outs, sometimes in different positions. But it's also allowed them to have a look at other players. And some players have actually really stepped up and put their hands forward for selection for the rest of the season going forward in the league. I mean, you mentioned it at the start of the show. I think all of us have been struck by Ollie Chesham over the last 2 weeks. I think he really put his hand up in that time, as well as others. I mean, I would write down in front of me Whitcomb, Clare, Hayes, Chesham, JVP, Lancaster, Porter, Hegarty, Kinney, Salamaki. I think all of them have put their hands up and said, actually, we're in the contention for a starting shirt. And then you look at the youngsters who have come through. So Edwards, Vaines, Agbonbon also showed up well. And I think, again, if you look at those, coming back to Brett's point of what we were trying to achieve over the last 2 weeks, I think you've got to say, you know what, results aside, they've done what they needed to do.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that the halftime rocket was introduced, because it was only 10 points, wasn't it, that we managed to score in that first half, despite being pretty dominant all over the park. It was actually a lovely try as well. JVP sniping, offloading to Kinney. And Kinney actually, again, looked a class above everyone all game. He was just there looking, he's so beautifully balanced for, you know, a chunky guy. He's got that lovely pickup speed, lovely balance running. But I'm going to bring it back to Chesham quickly, because we're going to talk about this perhaps at a more high level way than which we're used to. This podcast has previously been known as the George Martin Appreciation Society. It's also previously been known as the Guy Porter Fan Club. This is now going to become the Ollie Chesham supporters base, because my God, that guy is coming on leaps and bounds. I said it last week. He's showing leadership out there, and he hit another level. He got his hands on the ball a fair bit, and fuck me, I would not want to be a speed bump in his way when he's going full noise. Now, Adam, you came up with a comparison. Who was that?
Do you know what? Actually, forgive me. I think Chris has given me credit for somebody else's remark.
Oh.
Because I don't think that was me.
Claim it.
You've got better class than what we've done, because me and Mike would have claimed that.
I'll tell you what, I probably would have claimed it, but I've actually forgotten who it was. So that is the main reason.
You're afraid that it might be someone quite hard who's going to come out of the woodwork and call you out on it. But the name was Tom Croft. I've thrown in off air. I thought that I'm getting New Zealand lock vibes from him, sort of a Brody Retallick kind of figure. Obviously, he's not at that level yet, but he's only 20.
He will always be at least better looking than Brody Retallick. So, you know, that's always one step he's going to have ahead of him.
I mean, Brody Retallick's got a future in radio, hasn't he, with a face like that? Absolutely.
Oh my God, yes. either that or they might start making live action versions of Shaq. I mean, from that it's just made for life, basically.
Savage, absolutely savage. But Adam, you've been really impressed with what you've seen from Ollie Chesham, particularly over this season.
Yeah, there was that moment, wasn't there? There was Tommy Matthews, who was playing 10 for Wasps, picked the ball up. It was a kick over to the near side. And he was about 2-3 metres from the touchline. And he looked up, and there charging at him was Ollie Chesham, and absolutely smashed him and took him out of play. And I just thought, I cannot think, you know, the worst thing to look up to than Ollie Chesham running at you. Well, the thing that's impressed me most was that he was flirting with the first team up until the Northampton game, and he was given the opportunity. It was a little bit of luck that he was picked for that Northampton game. He had proved enough to get into the team, but it was because of international call-ups and injuries.
The fact that
Martin was away, for example, that meant that he was picked for that game. But he was sensational in that match, and he's been sensational since. I thought that, granted, the opposition was of a lower level. Of course it was in Wasps. Who, for example, you know, Wasps were a little bit all over the place. You know, they had basically, it was a lot of, you know, 18-year-old guys playing their first or second game. They looked talented, but it was a completely different, it was men against boys in almost a literal sense. But I still thought that Chesham played absolutely fantastically. He was a threat in so many different areas. He was a threat ball carrying. He was a threat in terms of turnovers when the opposition were in possession. He was a try scoring threat. And I thought that he has just taken the opportunity given to him and run with it. I think that's been a theme of Steve Borthwick's side, actually. You look at people like Harry Potter, who, you know, I'm not sure we were sure who was going to be playing right wing that first game of the season. He has been outstanding. You look at Nick Dolly, the prime example of that, who was Tigers' fourth choice hooker, recently out of Coventry, Sale, who didn't want him, and Jersey. And there he is playing for England over the weekend. He's a prime example of the type of person who seems to be able to take their opportunities. He's got a huge future ahead of him. And actually, you know, the discussion has been had, do Tigers need another second rower with Snaiman, Wells and Green? I'm not sure they do. I think they've probably not got the, I think emerges. They've got number four, yeah.
And we've got Henderson, obviously, who's...
And Henderson, yes.
I think I'd be disappointed now if we got a lock-in. As much as I could see the benefits of it, at the start of the season, I was all for getting another lock-in. Having seen how it's progressed, I think I'd be a bit disappointed if we got a star lock-in, because the ones we've got, I think, are really coming through, and I'd be worried about jeopardising someone like Henderson and Chesham and not getting them the game time, because they are really progressing. It reminds me actually of Tigers 15 years ago, where players would come out of nowhere, take an opportunity through injury, and suddenly become first choice. And that's exactly what's happening now. It's exactly how it was when Tigers at the peak of their powers. Players desperate to get involved, and as soon as they got a sniff of something, absolutely run with it and take on the charge. So it's a great cultural thing to have, where you can drop an injury and you've got people desperate and snapping on the heels to get involved.
Speaking of taking chances, something we didn't particularly do in the first half. Did you like that segue?
Loved it, good? Mate. Yeah, loved it.
Second half, you talk about the rocket, and we didn't have come flying out of the blocks. It was really impressive stuff, really aggressive. And again, I've got to emphasise it enough, it is against a very young Wasps team. But let's just take a step back and look at the Tigers team. Packed full of 20-year-olds, you know, in there as well, because you've got Whitcomb, you've got Hayes, who's only 22, and then Chesham. You've got
Tommy Raffel's only 22. JVP,
Martin, Kelly. You've got the most experienced unit on the pitch was the back three, who's supposed to be the quickest, but they were also the oldest guys we had on the field. The guy who impressed me, and again, as I said, it's been part of a fan club before, Guy Porter. He got two tries, playing in my mind, in his best position, 13. I know we sometimes shoehorn him out of the wing, but Jesus, he hits hard. He carries well. He's got all-round skill set. Chris, do you see him as a guy who can do a job there, perhaps, you know, a start to push for a first team place? Because I think at 13, I think he could be a real weapon.
I think it will take a bit to do yet, only because I think that's Matt Scott's best position as well, the way Tigers are set up. And you've also got a certain Argentine guy, Matheus Moroni. So not only has he got to get past
he's
one
got a queue.
International centre, he's got to get past another one. Having said that, though, yes, I agree. I think that is his best position, because I'm not sure he's quite got the pace to play on the wing, but I think outside centre actually suits him quite nicely. I agree that he does have hands, he does carry, he does do that very, very well indeed. He could even do a job at 12, I think, at a push if you needed, say, in the last 20 minutes of a game in particular. So, no, I think it's a really interesting pickup, actually, that Leicester made there in the last 18 months. I think he can fill. I don't know if he's kicked on as much as, say, Harry Potter has this season, partly because he's had a little bit of a niggle, hasn't he? He's not always been around, but also because Leicester have got three really decent centres at the club. So it's always going to be tough for him. But, yeah, he can do a job. And you need four decent centres, don't you, at any Premiership club? And Potter fills that last space.
And I think it's an awesome line again. Sorry, Mike. I mean, we talk about last week, his line for the try at the end. The first try he scored on Saturday, that line was just knife through butter. It really was.
Oh, the one close to the ruck.
Yeah, literally just popped it up straight through. I did think that was just an awesome line he picked. It's a nice talent to have as a centre, to be able to cut through like that on the angle. I think
where you can
really
hear sort of the train coming, kind of he's sort of just flying through short.
And
line.
He did that, of course, against Sale, didn't he? The previous weekend too, to seal off the victory. So look, he's in form. He's in form. He's pushing for a place. But by God, he's probably picked one of the toughest positions in the club to be able to try and get it.
It's interesting to say he's not kicked on as much as Harry Potter. Of course, that's because Potter, I think, is always primarily a winger, and he's been played as a winger, whilst Porter, when he's come in, has traditionally been very much filling in. And there you go.
The irony is there, Mike, from what I'm told, when they were at Sydney University, they both started out in the opposite positions.
Mm. Potter really?
Started out.
Yeah, they did. They did, yeah.
True. Potter started out as an outside centre, and Porter started out on the wing, but eventually probably the difference in pace has made a big difference.
I think Porter discovered the gym as well whilst he was at Sydney University. Because I did read he was a winger, and he's got good leadership, because I think he was a captain at Sydney University for a while. So I noticed he does do a lot of talking in defence. It'll be interesting. Like you say, you've got three centres there who can all play 12 and 13. The only one who can't, perhaps, is less flexible there is Moroni. You can perhaps play a bit more on the wing. But I completely agree with you, Chris. Having four centres who can do a good job, whoever's called on, is really exciting. And again, that's always been a weak spot for a few years.
The only thing, though, Mike, I would say is that all three of them, I don't know this, by the way, all three of them will probably be pushing for an increased contract for various reasons. All three, probably Porter, certainly Scott and Moroni.
Kelly would imagine as well, because Kelly was signed on a student deal. So again, he'd be one where in amongst it, where you'd probably be
The George Ford contract comes out. Yeah,
I don't disagree with that at all. But I think it's a problem at three, because now you've got Cicino arriving, who can easily fill that slot at 12. You've also got Lancaster, who, well, could play 10 or 12 especially. And suddenly there's now five centres. Mm. If you take Lancaster out of the equation, that's probably one too many. So it's a really, really tricky situation in the longer term, but it's a great solution to have, a great problem to have when you're in the club, less so for the players involved, potentially.
You mentioned Lancaster, Elliot. He was playing 10, and I thought he did a really fine job. I'm not convinced it's his best position. Doesn't look entirely natural there. What was your take on it?
I can understand where you're coming from. I think he's a really good distributor, but I don't know if it first up distribution is his forte. There was a few times where he would make a decision to go one way and almost need to check back because he wasn't quite sure if he'd made the right decision. So. But he's a young lad, and it takes time to bed in. It is hard when if you are a centre to play 10, because they are quite similar but altogether different skills to have. It's interesting to see what Dan Lancaster thinks himself, what's his best position. I'd be intrigued if someone should have a sit down with him and go, where do you see yourself? What do you want to be? Do you also want to be a 12 or as a 10? But I thought his game overall, I thought was pretty good. I think he kicked well out of hand. His distribution was good on the whole. His defence was pretty solid. What I was impressed by a few times when Andy got the opportunity, he was quite ambitious with kicking the ball to the corner. There was a few times where he managed to get it dead on the 5-6 metre line, which I think is a real good trait to have. And one of the things that Ford is spot on with compared to other fly halves in the league, he really does push that when kicking to the corner. And I think it gives us a good nudge in the right direction. So I was impressed when Lancaster was kicking to touch like that. He was quite ambitious and backed himself.
Definitely. He had a really good game overall. I'd like to see him perhaps abandon this sort of hop in the air thing he sometimes does, which I don't think buys him a lot of time. It allows a defence to come up and perhaps take away his space. But someone who was looking pretty sharp on their feet and managed to get not only his first try, but his second and third as well, was Hosea Samaki. Lovely guy, quiet guy. Now, there would be a tough interview for you guys, I suspect. But really happy to see him get on the score sheet. Adam, he still looks like a hell of a specimen, doesn't he?
He does. He's a really... that was a really solid performance from him, I thought. And he showed a little bit of everything in the different tries. There was a marvellous bit of footwork from him for the second try. He showed his physicality. One of them was almost like a forwards try, actually, just pushing players back to bundle
the winger
over.
That comes in and says, you fat boys have had too long with this now.
Yes.
I know how it's done.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Right. Bowling ball style.
He's obviously just taken a little bit of time to settle in. The difficult thing is, and we discussed this pre-season, I remember, was that they had two really exciting left wings in Salmaki and Ndolo, and they were struggling on the right wing as well. I think, but obviously Harry Potter has come into that position and done extraordinarily well. So I think that's just the problem at the moment. Is he ever going to displace Ndolo? But if he's there, you know, Ndolo's maybe got 2 years of top class stuff left in him. And if Salmaki is the ready and waiting, the heir to the throne, then he could be brilliant. He will be an outstanding replacement for him for the time being. If Ndolo is away, I think he offers the whole package. Also, he's one of those players that just has. He is quiet off the field, but there's a whole load of personality in the way he plays on the field, which I really like. The way he looks, you know, that sort of flash of peroxide hair on the top. He's a big, bulky boy. And there's just a lot of charisma about the way he plays, which I think is really exciting as well.
I like how he gets over the gain line every time he carries.
Yeah, he does.
Every time he made a carry, and he did the same against Saris. He took a kickoff in the league game, and he made his first run with it. He got over the gain line then. So it's a real good talent to have, consistently get over. I think we've been actually, it does show how lucky we've been all year with injuries, because a lot of those guys would have been banking on someone like Nadolo taking a hamstring strain or taking a knock or, you know.
Playing for Fiji.
Like you say, an international caller. I think I wouldn't say got away with it, because it's clearly a lot of the work that Alid and the wider team have done with the squad. But Sam Mackey's someone who probably could have benefited from Nadolo getting injured, but Nadolo hasn't. You know, Nemani's been fit every game. And be fair, if he's fit, he's going to get the gig. So it is testament. It's a knock-on, unintended consequence, I guess, of having such a good fitness regime at the club.
Chris, we're going to jump across the wings to Cobus van Vijk, one of the two van Vijks. We continued with our loose head prop at six experiment. And Francois did a fine job. I didn't see too much outstanding flanker play, but he did a good job, as he would do as a front row, and he carried well. He had a really good game. But Cobus on the other side, it must be galling to watch your teammate Wigger on the other wing score three while you score none. But he did set up a couple lovely unselfish pass for Samaki to score his final one. And he's a guy who's not had it all his own way. He came with, you know, a certain amount of expectation. Some of it has been luck, some of it has been bad judgment on his part when he's made silly mistakes and you know, had some bad discipline. But I thought he had a really sound game. Not spectacular, but I thought he had a really sound game. Do you think that he's got a future going at the club?
Only thing with Cobus van Vijk is to get him out of the Hurricanes would have taken a serious bit of wedge to pay him. And it's a winger. We're not talking a second row here. We're not talking about Aviza, who's literally involved in the whole game. You need your finishers, absolutely. And I just don't know that we've seen enough. It could be for any number of different reasons, but there's still time, but we're starting to run out of time now. And you start to wonder how many more opportunities he's actually going to get in the first team. Because we're just hearing Nadolo will start, Potter will start against Harlequins in a couple of weeks. And then who's going to be on the bench? Probably not Cobus van Vijk, unfortunately, for him. So he has to be patient, but I wonder if the die is already cast.
Yes, as you say, it's kind of the balance where his level of performance and achievement is that much higher because of the amount of cap that he takes up. And that is, I suppose, the fallback of the salary cap, isn't it? And it's the same for everyone.
It's always the way. It's always about balancing. How much value do you get out of a particular player? It's as... not exploitative, but it is what every club assesses with each individual player the further they go on in their contract.
Well, let's take a look at the 2 weeks as a whole. Brett Deacon obviously took charge and think it's been a really positive few steps for him as a coach. The mentality seems to have stayed there, that particularly in that first game against Sale, where they were up against a more experienced side and a very physical side. A side that does far too much of the woo-wing that has obviously been brought in from fucking hell, that winds me up. I don't know how everyone stays cool. I mean, that's probably why I play third team, throw your hands about rugby. But that was two very different games. And another example there of putting a team to the sword of really clinical attacking play, in that, particularly in that second half. If you're going to pick one guy who you think stood up enough over that, or a couple of guys over the first, over the last two games who have stood up to perhaps throw that out of the ring for first team selection. Who are you going with, Elliot?
For me, Chesham was mentioned, and Joe Hayes. I think Joe Hayes is a superb tight head prop and has been unlucky. He's been a victim of Dan Cole being awesome. So
I Dan think Cole's two, immortality has scuppered him.
I know. It is remarkable how well Coley has played, I've got to say. Of those who I listed earlier, I'd probably go with Joe Hayes and Ollie Chesham. I think those two, over the last couple of weeks, have been consistently superb. And I think they showed their first team class in amongst their peers.
What about you, Adam?
I'd say Chesham. I would say Murray Muravalu.
Good point.
For a different reason, which for what the Premiership Rugby Cup can offer you look at the younger players, but actually I think Marimo Rivalu has probably established a place on the bench as a result of his performance in this going forward. In terms of the players who came through otherwise, I thought Sam Edwards looked very good, very assured as a replacement scrum half. We only got to see one bit of him, but I think him as well, just for his 30 minutes. Lancaster as well, to a lesser extent, but I still thought he had a lot of talent, a lot of flair, managed the game really well. But what impressed me actually the most about the Wasps performance was, I don't think he started off very well actually, but he came into the game more and more, and in the middle section of the game, he controlled it and he got to grips with it. And then as the game started to progress and Tigers were running away with it, he showed a bit of creativity, a bit of flair in his game as well, which I thought really excited. I tend to agree with you that I think he's probably an inside centre, but he's a great option at 10 if they need him.
Definitely. Chris?
I'm going to have to go on that first game against Sale for obvious reasons. And I'd go for Hegarty.
Yeah, good point.
I think he showed... I hope he's okay. I don't think he featured at all, did he, in the 23
again? I think it was a head knock, so hopefully it's just the precautionary take a couple of weeks.
You really hope so. But before he did go off, he showed a vision. He showed that wider vision that you really want from attacking fly half. I think he'd be really entertaining as a 10, to be fair, going forward, because he likes to create stuff. You can tell he went to the Rugby League Academy initially in Brisbane Broncos, and I think he's got potential there at 10. I really do.
It's a really good shout.
It'd be just nice to see him on a field on a regular basis, wherever we can.
It's because, obviously, he came to Leicester having played a lot of his rugby at 15 for the Reds, but he did also play 10 for the Reds. And you forget, actually, that's his natural position. Is he does think of himself as being a 10. He's a 10 that can play 15, bit like Freddie Burns. Perhaps he's got a bit more experience of 15 than Freddie Burns does. But he's got that thing that I don't think you can really measure. You don't really know how they have it, but he has time. He has the ball. He doesn't look flustered. And that's what I don't think Lancaster quite has. He could develop it yet. Dan looks like he's currently looking for his options and may occasionally be, you know, chopped into a corner. But if you look at Hegarty, Burns, and obviously Fordy, looks like he's on fucking holiday when he gets the ball half the time. But, you know, it's brilliant. Look, we'll wrap it up there with the Leicester Wasps game. And I think, Adam, Chris, that we'll let you go. You've been absolutely fantastic being on, sharing with us the wealth of knowledge and the inner workings of the dark arts of the press. We haven't got onto your favourite method of bribery yet, but maybe that's for another pod.
I can just actually say the word fuck, because actually I can never say that on the BBC podcast as well, please.
I still can't bring myself to do it. I'm sorry.
Go on, Adam.
I can't.
Adam looks genuinely upset by that, but that's fine. We don't know where Chris Whitty is. He's probably on another call.
Nobody said that before, you know. I can't believe that's never come up before.
Yeah. We made a bit of a howler last week where we were teeing you both up, and we said, I think it was either me or you, Mike, and I can't remember who it was.
If it's a fuck up, it's generally coming from me.
This is actually going to stick, isn't it?
I'm all right with that. I don't mind that too much.
No, I don't either.
Chris, Adam, brilliant to have you on. Hopefully we'll catch up with you later on in the season as well.
That would be lovely. Yeah, thank you for asking us. It's been a pleasure.
Next time at our place.
You're cooking.
No.
Okay, then join me in the uncomfortably cramped elevator as we descend to the basement and into Elliot's Colts Corner, where we have some news that, frankly, Elliot and I have discussed off air and we're annoyed with. We're annoyed with the public, aren't we, Elliot?
Yeah, democracy is overrated. We've come to the conclusion. We don't like people. We don't like democracy. And it's a dictatorship from here on in.
Okay, so what you're saying is we need a revote. Just a revote until we get the vote we want, the result we want, and then we'll keep it that way.
Yes, I mean, there's political jokes to be made here, but I'm staying very clear of them. But yes,
I'm Nicola Sturgeon. There. Done. There we are. That makes me edgy.
Yeah, that's it. Yes, to be fair, the number 8 shirt got chosen, and Thomas Waldrum was the winner with 56%. And I don't normally want to have a moan, but you fucked up there, people. Henry Tuilagi should have got into the final. Waldrum should never have got through into this final stage. And Lockie McCaffrey should have been an absolute sure-fit winner for the final poll. But I blame myself. I put Waldrum in. I blame myself.
Don't feel bad because I blame you too. So if that makes you feel any better. Now, to be fair, look, let's talk about Waldrum. He's a great player, great footwork, and, you know, he did a lot of good for the club. I just think that in terms of the, you know, cult hero status or unsung hero status, you've got Henry Tuilagi or Lockie McCaffrey or Will Johnson and Eric Miller, all of whom I would rate above Thomas Waldrum. But the people have spoken, and of course, we are going to do a subs bench, so there is still time for these guys to work their way back in. And Lockie McCaffrey, I would say, is the perfect sub because he can, of course, play all three positions.
Absolutely. I quite agree with that. It also means that the pack is now complete. So do you want me to run through who we've got?
Yes, please.
As the pack. So front row of Boris Stankovic, Benjamin Kaiser and Darren Morris. Leo Cullen and Jim Hamilton.
It's almost the same bloke, kind of like just repeated three times, isn't it? Like at different ages of their career and like different, slightly different hair. But yeah, it's the same sort of size of guy. Excellent.
Leo Cullen and Jim Hamilton in the second row.
Big.
Steve Maffey, Julian Salvi and Thomas Waldrum in the back row. So it's not a bad pack when you look at it.
That back row, I think, actually legitimately played together quite a lot, I reckon. I reckon if we go through the team sheets, I think we'd have probably found that back row playing together for most of the season.
I agree. It's actually as it goes, a partnership that works. And I think Leo Cullen and Jim Hamilton probably played together a fair amount as well. I'm not sure if that front row as a combination ever really played together. I think Boris and Darren Morris probably didn't quite overlap as much. Well, as they might.
Maybe we've done the people a disservice. Maybe they're thinking of the back row as a unit, as of course you should do for any team. But they're thinking, well, yeah, we've got Maffey and Salvi there, and we know how Waldrum works with them. So there we go for familiarity. Well done. Tactically astute, everyone. But you're wrong. We're going to move on to the nines now. And it's going to be more contentious selections, I believe.
Well, I was going to say, I think in the same way that we had in other positions, the nine shirt is actually a tough one to pick for it because we've had so many great nines over the years that are so iconic. It's hard to pick, think of people to go with it. But, however, happily, there are many, we have, between us and the people, managed to find some selections, which is a good thing. So I'll start off with my choice, a fine choice, if I may, do say myself. Big Sam Harrison, I think, is the epitome of cult corner material. Anyone that has a photo taken with a Premiership trophy, with a can of Stella in their hand, instantly makes it as cult material. Sam is a great guy, proper Leicester, proper Hinkler. And, you know, anyone that retires at 31 to go off and play, go surfing on Australia, wins it for me and my book. You know, peak your power, go off and quit whilst you're ahead.
Good name as well, Shazam.
Yeah, that's it. Booting the ball, running away from them all, booting the ball into the crowd as your final moment in a Tiger shirt, I think is absolutely fantastic. Understudy, loyal understudy to Ben Youngs, always did a job for us, never complained about being on the
field.
Filled
in at fly off more than once as well.
Yeah, played on, I'm pretty sure he played on the wing as well. So, look, for me, he's everything that being a Tiger is all about. Unsung hero, cult hero in his own right. I think he hits both of the measurements we're going for. So, for me, it's Sam Harrison for the nine shirt.
I think you've picked a front runner there, mate. I think he's excellent. What I love is that I've keep tabs on him in Australia, not in a weird way. I just like to keep an eye on, you know, what he's
up to.
You're
stalking, mate. Let's call it what it is.
Casual sort of cross-hemisphere stalking. And, you know, he's playing obviously for his local club out there. What I love about it as well, he's got this mix between like the Aussie surfer tan. So he's gone full in that now, which looks great with his blonde locks. And then he's also gone the recently retired, I don't give a shit anymore bit. Beer gut, that's there as well. And it's just a quality mix. And he's still playing rugby for a local club. I think he's playing a bit of 9 and 10. And of course, he's just gone there. He looks like the least professional person out of all of them. And he's still won, I think, player of the league, not just player of the season for his team, but player of the season for the league. So he's still doing the business. He's a great shout, great lad as well. Like I say, proper Leicester bloke. So I think you've got a really good option there. I'm going to go on a slightly different direction of mine, but just for how iconic I think he was. I think he's fucking brilliant. But Julien Dupuis, le français. You know, like if you said, exactly. Just draw me a Frenchman, and it is Julien Dupuis. That's it, isn't it? And, you know, it's so many iconic moments there. I mean, there was a try he scored against Bath where I think he turned around looking for Sam Vesti or Toby Flood or something like that. And he turns around and goes, ah, Le Gap. And he just sort of walks through and he's kind of got this lazy look on his face. He just sidesteps. I think it was a bender and then scores under the post at the Walker Stadium, and as it was then. And it was fucking brilliant. And then, of course, who can forget when he's off in the... Who were we playing when he was in the change?
Cardiff. It's the Cardiff knockout. It's the penalty shootout game.
And he came back on, didn't he? And he was there sort of sat in his Y-fronts, because all Frenchmen wear Y-fronts, I don't know if you know. And he was sat there smoking a fag, which is what you do. And somebody says, Julian, we need you to come back on for blood so you could, you know, take some kicks, you know, or Bloodgate or whatever it was, I don't know. But anyway, so he goes and pulls on his shirt, comes back, nails his kick, and, you know, the rest is history. I think he was a great player. I know that he did end up playing for France, but I don't think he played for France whilst he was at Tigers. And he was very much in a 50-50 battle with Harry Ellis. I think he saw a lot of first-team action because that was after Harry Ellis had his knee wrecked by that tit, Ian Evans, for the Ospreys. So I think Julien Dupuis is an excellent shout, if I do say so for myself. I don't know if he's got enough to beat Suzanne Harrison, therefore. I have to say
that the try against Bath will remain one of the great moments, I think, for Tigers. Memorably, we were at that game and my old man had injured his leg, the one he'd broken years ago. So he was on crutches and obviously was in a fair amount of discomfort. However, lobbed the crutches when Dupuis went through and celebrated like the best of them. It was almost like the pain didn't matter for that 30 seconds.
It was almost like he was a benefit fraudster.
I don't want to say anything, but I'm shocked at it. But got to start somewhere. But yeah, for that 30 seconds, as Dupuis ran into the post and it all went absolute bedlam in the stadium, my old man's leg was mysteriously...
He's healed! It's a miracle!
Yeah, and I think then once he came back down to earth, the pain kicked back in. He could barely walk out of the ground. But no, it was a fantastic moment. And... a couple of people did mention Harry Ellis. I have to say Harry's a bit too big time for this, but he was a great Tigers player.
And I'd almost go as far as to say is, if injury had hampered him, he could have been one of the best scrum halves, if not the best scrum half the club has ever had. Yes, I think he is unbelievably good.
Yeah, he was absolutely sensational. But I think Dupuis is a great choice. So you've got Sam Harrison for me, Julien Dupuis from yourself. And then we pass over to the people who I'm not sure we can trust anymore. I've got to be honest. But we'll go through some of the suggestions. And we've got three I think we can have a look at. We've got Carduni, Jamie Hamilton, and the housewife's favourite, Frank Murphy.
I want to trump Frank Murphy, if I may, because I've seen one that hasn't been mentioned that I think should be.
Go on. What you got?
It's big.
Talk to me.
Wasali Serevi.
Oh.
About one season. The world's greatest sevens player. I'm not saying he was any good for us particularly, but fucking come on. It's Wasali Serevi playing for the Tigers. Little moments of magic. No interest in tackling the big props running down his channel whatsoever. It's Wasali Serevi. I've got to throw him in there for pure cult iconography. He's incredible.
It probably fits the requirements of didn't really play for us for very long, but was iconic.
He didn't even play that brilliantly well. That's what I love about it. But he's still kind of, I think even a lot of people will still now look at him with fond memories just to say, Serevi played for us. That's awesome.
I have to say, it is a fantastic, fantastic choice. Jamie Hamilton is one of those understudy for Austin Healey. Ideal club man. He always came in and did a good job.
Almost an earlier sort of version of Shazam, really, wasn't he? And that he sort of always filled in, did a good job, was never first choice, but never moaned about it.
Yeah, it always played really well every time it was asked. And occasionally did get in the gig for some of the big games as well due to injury. Frank Murphy, similar sort of vibe, never first choice, but always did okay when played. Memorably played the Guinness Premiership final in 07.
Fair play.
When Harry Ellis and Scott Beamond got injured, so Frank Murphy came in. He is now a referee, so we probably should include him because if he does win, it might help us with refereeing decisions.
That's a stretch, but okay, yeah, good.
Old-fashioned bribery, we will do it. And then Cardoni, I cannot, to be honest, a bit before my time, so I can't really comment about it, I think.
Cardoni, I can remember because he was sort of one of the first guys. Him and Jez Harris were the 9-10 combination when I first started watching Tigers. He did play for Tigers for a long time, but if we're only going for the professional era, technically he only played for 2 years. The only thing I'd say is technically he was first choice for those 2 years. But I think because it's so long ago, I think he does fit it. And he was a hell of a player and really unusual backstory. You don't get too many sort of Iranian rugby players out there. And he's today stands, I think, probably won the premierships, if not the only Iranian guy to have played rugby in the premiership.
That is absolutely fantastic. So yet again, Mike, do we do a semi-final before the final?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, as co-founder of this podcast, I'm demanding Serevi gets in there, even if you have to do a four-way vote.
I think we can do a four-way. So if we do Serevi, Cardoni, Jamie Hamilton and Frank Murphy, we'll leave it up as always for a couple of days. And in the winner, we'll go through to face Sam Harrison and Dupree. And if you choose wrong, we will have to have words with you.
We'll take away privileges.
Yeah. A naughty step will have to be looked at. But no, we'll do the semi-final then. Cardoni, Hamilton, Murphy, Serevi, couple of days, then the final. And in the meantime, we turn our attentions to fly half. So if you can get your 10 suggestions across, I think this could be quite an interesting thing, considering where we are as a club. We need to find a first choice 10. If you can give us some cult hero 10s, that would be quite good.
I think we need to again remind people that it can't be someone who already plays for the club, because I've already seen Freddie Burns' name mentioned. You can't curse people with cult corner if they're a current player.
Yeah, it's not fair on them.
All right, well, now we're just going to turn our attention to the internationals and Tiger Watch. I'm not going to ask Elliot to do the Raw this time. Didn't quite work.
It's not quite my bag, mate. But we don't just have Tiger Watch. We've got Tiger King 2 out. There's a lot of Tiger action going on at the moment.
Oh,
Tiger King
2 is back on Netflix. There's not a follow-up, is there?
Of course there is, mate. I'm 2 episodes in. It is hilarious.
Has Carol Bastian admitted yet to killing her ex-husband?
You know me, I will not be giving any spoilers away.
Okay, very, very fair. Well, we'll see. I kind of lost my tether with this at the end. I was just like, these people are ridiculous. We stop giving them the time of day. But then now you've mentioned it, I do want to see what's happening. So we'll just take a quick run around the grounds and see what's been going on. Obviously, Matt Scott didn't play for Scotland this week. They went back to Sam Johnson in the centres. He was a very good player, to be fair. So I thought he was unlucky. He didn't do anything wrong against South Africa at all. We then obviously go to the big game, as far as we're concerned, which was England against South Africa. What a game. Really tense. Not completely, actually, when I say what a game, completely put in the shade by the New Zealand-France game earlier, which was fucking mental. Just a quick one on that. If I was going to do a moan this week, I've got something else to moan about, as you know, but my backup moan would be about French TV directors. You know that bit... That bit when Antimac sort of he's got the ball behind his own try line in the dead ball area, and he skins Scott Barrett, breaks out, gets up to the 22, and then puts a blind pop pass over his left hand shoulder for the fullback Jaminet, who hairs up line. It's just one of the most sublime bits of play I've ever seen. And the French TV director afterwards, his mentality must have been, and nobody wants to see a blind pop pass after a man has just done a Houdini out of his dead ball area. No, 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 no. What people want to see is Ardie Savea blowing his cheeks out in super slow motion. It's like, I don't want to fucking see. I don't care about that. Show me that moment of genius. Oh, never mind. But that was fantastic. But anyway, the England-South Africa game, obviously fantastic. And I touched on this at the start of my intro. Got emotional again seeing Freddie Stewart. He's just proving everyone what we already knew, but he was sublime again against South Africa. Really stern test in the first half. Not only was he superb in the air, I thought his passing was excellent, and particularly off his left hand, which I think previously has been a weakness. It shows he's worked on it. He threw a couple of beautiful passes to Malins to make breaks. He beat Diallende with a lovely sidestep, say flawless in the air in the first half. Hell of a try. I think he took over Khaleesi, Reinach, and Pollard, I think, with just sort of head down and big drive and got over the line for that. That was absolutely fantastic to see. And in the second half, I think he dropped a couple at the end, but that was only because they'd pulled their kicks back at 5 to 10 meters and were getting guys in there, taking the space before he got there. It was borderline naughty play, but you know they had to do what they had to do to get the ball back. And if you force a team to pull their tactical kicks back as a fullback, you've pretty much done your job. I thought he was absolutely sensational. And the picture, do you see the picture of him hugging his granddad? And his granddad with tears in his eyes.
See, I think you had tears in your eyes.
Oh, no, the granddad, granddad has tears in his eyes. It did kick me pretty solidly in the feels, though, I have to say.
I have to say, the you talk about the Autumn Internationals. In all the games, of all everyone that come out of it well, Arthur Eddy has come out of it looking absolutely superb. I do think he's booked himself in for that 15 slot now for the next 10 years. I mean, he looks to the manner born. Just in every aspect of the game, at fullback, he's just on it. Like, he's actually on it. I think what we probably need to mention here is that he's actually got a bit of a rugby brain on him. Do you know what I mean? We talk about his all his attributes and the skill sets he's got. He is a thinking man's player. And I think you can actually start to see that now. He's actually blossoming that aspect of his game and he's starting to look... He just looks to the manner born in international rugby, I have to say. To be honest, you could picture him in a Lions shirt and he wouldn't look
Another great 15 for Ireland. Hugo Keenan's had a great autumn as well, to be fair. Maybe that's the battle for the next, you know, 2 to 3 Lions tours there. That's really exciting.
But yeah, I think Freddie, to be fair, come away with it looking superb. So absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and he's such a lovely guy. Whenever you see him interviewed, very down to earth. And, you know, that George Ford money, some of it needs to be spent on giving him a nice big fat contract to tie him down for the next 5 to 10 years. That's the key thing to do here.
Terrible tash, though.
Oh, he had a great November and a dreadful Movember. But yeah, it just makes me feel more depressed about sort of my own rugby ability when there's a guy there who he's not even got a hair on his chest and barely on his upper lip and he's playing like that. What an absolute star he is. Playing with him, of course, is Ben Youngs. Didn't get quite the plaudits. Had a weird game, actually, because his kicking was weirdly off, I thought, at the start. Or it was. He did one too long, then he did one too short, and then he did the most sublime grubber off the outside of his foot to box them in and give ourselves a 5-metre scrum. That's where we scored our first try from. So that was fantastic. And actually, his decision-making was really, really good in the first half. He was actually similar to what Marcus Smith did to put Freddie's Stewart away in the first game when he put Freddie Stewart over this time. He just took a little dart, a little slow, took Khaleesi kind of half out of it so he couldn't put in a big shot and Stewart, and that's what gave him the half yard he needed to score.
No, so, totally.
So after, I thought he was really good. I think he started to lose his way a little bit as the South African onslaught came on. It was a hell of an onslaught. And it was a time it was right to bring on Rafi Quirk then, not necessarily because Youngley had a bad game, but that was the right time to introduce that energy. Visa came off the bench, didn't get binned, which was good for South Africa. I actually thought he had overall a positive impact. He was very energetic. Good to see, but I was delighted to see him on the losing side by the end of that one. And then obviously the only other game where nearly forgot. Nick Dolly making his introduction into Test rugby at a critical point against the world champions, against the world's best front row. And I thought he did all right.
And got involved in the handbags as well. Didn't shy away from any of that nonsense. Got fully on, stuck involved. And the mullet made its way onto international rugby.
Absolutely. The line-out was a bit ropey before he came on, and it continued that way when he did come on. It's not his. Not going to blame him entirely for that because they were well stuck into our set piece. But he did some really good tackles, got about the park, and like you say, he wasn't shying away from Malcolm Marks like I would adopt the fetal position in front of him if I had to go up against him. Move on to the Argentina game. Very quickly, pretty well dealt with by Ireland after a good start. But again, Thomas Lavanini, in case we ever wondered if it was the right decision to let him go, fuck me. He goes there and clatters Kian Healy in the head, although it was quite ironic to hear Peter O'Malley goes, "Oh, scumbag, you know exactly what you're doing." Yeah, well, Peter Armani's got form there as well. But I thought...
Underneath a referee's nose is always the best way to clatter someone in the head.
Flying off his feet, horizontal into someone's head. I mean, my God, man. Anyway, but I thought Moroni was very quiet. He was pretty well shackled, didn't really see a lot of good attacking ball. It's often the way, unfortunately, the way Argentina are playing. But again, I've seen conversations about Montoya afterwards saying, do we need to have a conversation about him being one of the world's best hookers? And I think we do. I think there were a couple of lineouts that went wrong, but that was after Lavanini went off. But in the scrum, he's superb. In the loose, he's just unbelievable. Hell of a captain, hell of a leader. And I certainly hope we can hang on to him. So great work by Montoya. Less good by Lavanini. And unfortunately, that's Autumn International. It's all done and dusted now. Back to good old club rugby. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of this week. In case you're wondering why there isn't a preview for next week, well, but we don't have a game. Elliot and I were going to be lazy and take the week off, but Elliot probably needs the week off because he's moving house. But instead, we are going to be doing a separate preview pod for the game the following week, which is against Harlequins, probably the biggest game of the season. And to celebrate that, we're hopefully having our counterparts from the Harlequins podcast on, where we can sort of slag each other off and share some perhaps fond or less fond memories about previous games between the two, because there's been some crackers, and this one looks like potentially joining those ranks as well, to be fair. So that should be super exciting. But apart from that, I don't have anything else to add. Do you?
Nothing for me, mate.
I am going to have one very quick bone, and that's about the South African extremist fans in response to, well, firstly, Razzie Erasmus's punishment, which is richly deserved. Razzie Erasmus, brilliant coach. Absolutely shit bloke for what he did to Nick Berry, and he's got what he deserved. The delusion some of these guys have, they think there's a fucking conspiracy. You saw a little bit of a Twitter war that I ended up having with someone today because they thought, again, the referee had robbed them. And it's legitimate. They legitimately think they've been robbed.
It is amazing the sort of delusion levels that they have reached. I have to say, you're doing a sterling job of staying patient with him. I'd have cut that conversation in half. What I found hilarious about the whole thing is when you said, "Find me the law that backs up your moan." Six times you asked him to find the law. Six times he couldn't.
Six times he responded by calling me a fucking knob, which is amazing because I haven't heard being called a knob since I was 11. And part of me thinks, fair play, bring that back in. You know, start going around calling people a knob again. But this was about at the end where he complained about the England substitutes encroaching on the field. Which, if you look at the law, the only law that there is that says that you can deal with encroachment is that the referee orders them off. And as long as they walk off, there is no penalty to be conceded. The game restarts. And it happened whilst the game was dead as well and didn't affect play. So there's no rule to be had. And actually, if you ask these people about to point to the rule, as I've found out today, either the guy was illiterate, which might be true, or he just can't find it. He said he just kept pointing to videos. These people do videos moaning about it. They're proper pundits who have a complete bleat. It's a shame to see such a proud rugby nation of great rugby players dragging their own nation's reputation through the mud, but thankfully taking the English reputation of being the world's worst whingers. So keep at it, lads. Keep at it. It's embarrassing for you, but good for us.
Can't argue with any of that, mate.
All right. Well, that's it from us. Say we will be back next week. It'll be purely a preview pod. And until then, have a great week and stay safe.
Take it easy, guys.